Well, I received the invitation with mixed emotions. I was naturally gratified, but it was under the shadow of the absence of an old and close friend, Edward Said, who, as you know, fought a long and courageous struggle with incurable cancer, but succumbed before he was able to deliver lectures here, which is an immeasurable loss to you, to everyone anywhere who cares about freedom and justice and intellectual and cultural achievement. But I'm happy at least to be able to speak in his memory. To turn to the topic, by comparative and historical standards, we are all fortunate to enjoy great freedom. Freedom plainly offers opportunity. Opportunity confers responsibility. Responsibility to use the freedom that one enjoys wisely, honestly, and humanely. We also happen to live in centers of enormous power. Accordingly, our decisions as to how to face our responsibilities are sure to have far-reaching consequences. I want to concentrate on one case primarily, a case that everyone agrees is of enormous significance, reaching quite literally to issues of human survival. That's the question of resort to force in international affairs, how its legitimacy has been understood over time, how it is today. As you know, the hideous crimes of the 20th century led to dedicated efforts in 1945 to save humans from the curse of war. And the word save is no exaggeration. Surely, since it became clear in 1945 that the likelihood of ultimate doom is well beyond what any rational person would be willing to tolerate. Actually, the phrase ultimate doom is not mine. I'm borrowing it from two prominent strategic analysts writing in the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, not given to hyperbole. They conclude that Washington's current military programs and aggressive stance, quoting them, carry an appreciable risk of ultimate doom. And they express the hope that the threat that the U.S. administration is posing to the world and to the American people will be countered by a coalition of peace-loving nations led by China. We've come to a pretty pass when such thoughts are expressed at the heart of the establishment, and what that implies about the state of American democracy is no less shocking and threatening, and you may consider, leave it to you to consider what the judgments imply about Britain, which was not expected to lead the coalition. In considering their reasons, the reasons that led them to these conclusions, a good place to start is with an event that actually took place after their article appeared, but is typical. Last November, at the United Nations Committee on Disarmament, it's basically the General Assembly, which voted to support a treaty to ban production of fissile material for nuclear weapons. The vote was 147-1. There were two abstentions. The one you can guess. The two abstentions were Israel, which is reflexive, and Britain, which explained its abstention on the grounds, I'm quoting the British ambassador, on grounds that the resolution had divided the international community at a time when progress should be a prime objective, divided it 147-1, so obviously. Actually, we gain some insight into the ranking of survival of the species on the list of priorities. not only by the vote, but by the publicity it received. Unfortunately, it's only one of many illustrative examples. The efforts to end the curse of war led to a consensus on the principles that should guide state action. That's the United Nations Charter. The consensus and subsequent declarations and treaties. The consensus was reiterated last December by a high-level UN panel, which included the National Security Advisor for George Bush the First. It was reiterated again by Kofi Annan a couple of days ago. The panel reiterated the conclusions of the United Nations